Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Sidorit Group Semi-Annual Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note this call may be recorded, and I will be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Tom Sidorit. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chloe, and thank you all for joining us today. We're delighted to have you on the call. We're going to try something a little new for all of us today. We're going to have much more of a discussion-type format as opposed to what I would call a lecture where I talk at you and talk about all the wonderful things we've done. I think there's a lot going on, as you well know. 2019 was a particularly unusually kind year to all of us, and we'll get into a little bit of that, but we're going to have a discussion as opposed to a directed conversation. We hope it will be beneficial to you. We're always trying to improve our messages, and these conference calls are basically aligned with our other forms of communication, which whether it be our website, thesidorgroup.com, our growing and substantial presence on social media, and also the fact that we're now going to be launching team LinkedIn and Facebook pages in the near future. So before we get into the discussion with Casey, and I thought we might have a little look back on 2019. 2018 was a year that memories are short, but 2018 was a year that didn't generate any positive returns whatsoever in any asset class except cash. Ironically, 2019 was the exact opposite. 2019, everything worked, and I mean everything. So it did. Commodities did well, stocks did well, domestic stocks did well, foreign stocks did well, bonds did exceedingly well, gold rallied, emerging markets, everything worked, and you all saw it on your statements in December. And we got a lot of kind words from all of you, which we appreciate. But remember, we're going to try and put things in context because our role is to provide context. And I think 2019, if it does anything to us, reminds us the value of patience because 2018 wasn't a very easy year to be patient in. 2019 was. So, Casey, I think you've got a few things you want to address or questions you might have about 2019.
So why don't we dig into that a little deeper? So, Tom, I'm going to ask you some questions that we've received from others or about key themes that we think are important when we look ahead. So as it relates to 2019, you and I have talked about it being more of an anomaly or an unexpected year, but can you expand on some of the key reasons as to why 2019 was so unusual?
Well, there are a number of reasons. Obviously, there was a lot of geopolitical and trade news and tension over that, but the real story in 2019 was a significant decline in interest rates. Many of you might remember in 2018, the Fed tried to jack interest rates up a little bit, which led to a fairly significant sell-off in the markets in the fourth quarter of 2018. 2019, the Fed took its foot off the gas and didn't raise rates further, and in fact dropped them. So 2019 is really a story of interest rates. It fueled a dramatic rise in equity prices and an almost equity-like return in the bond markets. The other thing that's fascinating about 2019 is that now marking one of the longest recoveries ever in history since I think the late mid-1800s, and there are very few developed countries that have had longer expansions in the last 10 years that we've experienced. So it's unusual, but not unprecedented.
Well, to that point, economic expansions or recoveries don't die of old age. And based on what you just said, other developed countries have had really long expansions. So what's the difference between our current economic expansion and recoveries of years past?
So a lot of people point to Australia and the dramatic ongoing growing economy they've had up until recently, and that's really a function of kind of a one-time event, which is China being their biggest trading partner. The current economic expansion, at least domestically, has lagged previous recoveries primarily because there's been no wage growth. Normally, when you have a recovery like this, you start to see wages start going up, and they're only slightly going up now. The other component that makes this one unique is the fact that we've had this technological deflation, you know, the Amazon effect, where prices, rather than be rising, should be the case during an expansion, they're actually not rising that much, except in probably healthcare. And I think the other thing that's unique is more related to policy issues, which it's very, very unusual to have the Federal Reserve Bank accommodating an economy while Congress delivers these huge tax cuts while they're spending way beyond their means 10 years into recovery. Normally, policy like what we've seen recently, which is tax cuts and stimulus, only occur during recessions.
Right. So on the subject of the Fed and central banks, you know, they've all continued with their accommodating low interest rate policies. And as you just said, it's a story of interest rates. And clients keep hearing this. And after that rate increase in late 2018, interest rates today around the globe are again closer to their 5,000-year lows as referenced back in 2016. So my question here is, you know, can you tell me or us how clients benefited from the interest rate decline in 2019?
Sure. I think we all saw, you know, near double-digit returns in our portfolios in 2019. What was interesting is that we're running balanced portfolios, so much of our clients' assets are in fixed income or bonds. They generated returns that were a little mind-boggling, quite frankly, because interest rates were falling. So just remember, everybody, that when interest rates fall, bond prices actually rise. And we saw returns in our fixed income components and segments of our portfolios that were generating returns very similar to how equities are generating returns. So this is a concern going forward, you may want to quiz on that, Casey, but the fact of the matter is, bonds with interest rates falling are signaling that the recovery is relatively anemic.
So, I mean, so what you just mentioned, right, the within the bond market, we were witnessing equity-like returns. And just to add, for those on the call, we as a team, and in many cases last year, we were rebalancing fixed income to realize some of these gains. So many of you saw activity in October and September of 2019. We are gearing up for another rebalancing effort as it relates to fixed income and interest rates. But I want to go back just for a second on, you know, now that interest rates are so low, yes, the recovery may be anemic, but what does that translate to as it relates to returns in fixed income as we think about 2020, you know, through 2025, for example?
Well, I guess the prospect is the only thing that could generate the types of returns we had in fixed income again would be something that Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, this morning said coming from Davos. He said the thing that keeps him up at night is negative interest rates. So if you think about it, the only thing that could generate fixed income returns as we had in 2019 would be if interest rates in the United States went negative. And we don't think that's impossible, but it is certainly possible, but you think about what negative interest rates signal about the broader economy.
So in other words, we don't want that to happen.
Well, it would be historic, wouldn't it now?
Yeah.
Biggest economy in the world with negative interest rates. Everybody else is, you know, some of the central banks have backed away from it, and we haven't had to go there yet, but I could see it developing if we have another fairly significant recession.
Well, so if the bond market is priced in a way where we could expect, let's say, below average returns, let's divert our attention to the stock market, and especially the U.S. So in your opinion, Tom, you know, what does the U.S. stock market look like today?
By historical measures, it's expensive. It's very expensive. And that's telling you something when somebody like a Warren Buffett, who is fairly legendary in investor circles, is holding record amounts of cash right now at Berkshire Hathaway. Part of the reason their returns were subpar, in fact, in some cases less than ours, is because they're sitting on huge amounts of cash because they don't see any value.
So if in taking that message, and now instead of sort of recapping 2019, we begin to look ahead. And some of the key themes that, as we look ahead, as it relates to the U.S. stock market, you know, do you believe the U.S. stock market is apt to deliver its historical average, let's say, over the next 10 years?
I think it's a great question, and I think the answer is whenever you have a period of rich valuations, as you have right now, it is rare that the market will U.S. stock market will generate the kinds of returns going forward that it has. I remember, and I think you've seen the chart, Casey, of when I was cautioning people at the end of 1999, we'd gone through two decades of really generous returns, and back then we were kind of cautioning about this term called regression to the mean, which is we're going to get back to an average return on equities of 8 or 9%, and these double digits you've had are not going to continue. And sure enough, in 1999, we didn't know how it was going to end, but it did end with the dot-com bubble, and then eventually 2008 came along with the Great Recession.
So U.S. equity valuations are rich, call it below average returns expected. The bond market interest rates are low. What would you consider realistic when you think about the next decade in terms of setting expectations?
So I, to be cautious, I've been using the number 3 to 4% returns, which is not just our calculations that we've done or the capital market assumptions we have with our partners at Raymond James. It's also things that you see like coming out of the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, which has announced they're dropping their assumed rate of return. Vanguard just came out with a report very similar that anybody that's assuming 7 or 8% on average in the equity markets is probably dreaming. So we're trying to set expectations that we're going to be lower for longer. And what's troubling about this lower for longer paradigm is that all the public pensions are still assuming something north of a 7% average return, which mathematically is pretty hard to attain.
Well, and a subject that you touched on briefly, but I think is relevant to this, is the wild card of negative rates, negative interest rates. And we touched on this theme over the summer of 2019 when at the time about 25% of global government debt or bonds, equaling about $17 trillion, traded with negative yields. And now this number has come down some since then, but you know, what is the wild card effect of negative rates when we think about the next 10 years or even the next recession?
I think the wild card of historically low or even if we go negative rates are the first and second derivative of the implications of what that does. So I mentioned pensions a minute ago. They're all assuming a normal rate of return, and they typically are big fixed income buyers. All their math goes out the window. All the actuarial assumptions go out the window. And the taxpayer gets on the hook for all these pensions that are promised to others. I think the other implications across the financial services world, the financial intermediaries, like insurance companies and banks, they will really suffer. And I think that's why Jamie Dimon said this morning that the thing that keeps him up at night is negative interest rates. I think they're quite possible, and the implications for the financial sector will be significant.
What about other assets? I mean, you know, if you had to choose between accepting a low return over here or maybe paying more for something over there, you know, how might this negative interest rate bucket or pot of money impact pricing of other investments?
So using the term regression to the mean again, if you look at the United States, which has been on fire pretty much for the last decade since the Great Recession, other markets around the world have not been. And that actually presents relative value. So if you look at dividend yields and valuations in Europe or overseas in Asia, the valuations are much, much cheaper, and the dividend yields are better. So it's not that we're without opportunity, but it may be in a different part of the planet. So I think anybody that has a domestically centered portfolio may be asking for trouble down the road because the returns can't be quite as generous as they've been. And maybe you're missing out on some of these other things that could be happening in other places.
So I want to change gears on you now and move over to the world of taxes because something big happened at the end of 2019. and I'm referring to the SECURE Act here. This is something that we've been discussing with clients since the spring of 2019 and surrounds a theme, that being tax efficiency, that is central to what we do. Would you provide a brief overview about some of the key takeaways of the SECURE Act? You know, break it down. Tell us what it's about.
Well, first of all, I think in our conversations, you know, the SECURE Act was, I think the name is misleading. I think whenever you hear cute acronyms out of D.C., you should watch out. But the SECURE Act was kicking around for a long time in Washington, was getting bipartisan support, and then kind of the last minute, 11th hour, it gets tacked onto a bill and passed in December of last year. The SECURE Act key takeaways are the elimination of the stretch provision for non-spouse beneficiaries. That's a big deal. That's essentially a taxation on the next generation. And it shows, I think, more importantly, kind of this tone of what Congress has in mind for us, which is this 11th hour tax passage. So I was talking to an accountant earlier today down in Florida, and he said, I'd just like to go through one December where they don't jam out massive tax changes that we can't plan around. So December of 17 was the last major tax bill, and once again, our friends in Congress, in the interest of trying to pass a budget or something like a budget, passed this huge taxation change, and it really undoes decades and decades of retirement planning. It repeals the maximum age of traditional IRA contributions, which is kind of a minor issue, I think. It increases the required minimum distribution age, RMD age, from 70 to 72. That's kind of a bone they threw out. And it permits parents to withdraw $5,000 from retirement accounts penalty-free, or parents to withdraw up to $10,000 from 529 plans to repay student loans. So there's a couple bones in there. But most of all, this is a huge tax grab and revenue grab by Congress. And I think it sends a message as to what the tone is going to be. And if you're not thinking about tax policy going forward, you probably should.
Well, so can you give a brief example of the stretch IRA? I mean, it's second language to us. We talk about it all the time. But for those on the call, you know, what's a simple example of how that's now going to be different?
Well, it was a huge benefit to the – so if I croak tomorrow and my daughter or my son's got my IRA, they'd be able to stretch it out over their lifetime. Now what Congress wants is for you to pay it out in 10 years, which basically means they get to accelerate the taxation on that IRA. A lot of folks are waking up to the fact that the money was only deferred and not tax-free, as many of the 401k sponsors tried to promote, or IRA sponsors. But the reality is they're really trying to accelerate the taxation on those assets. They see this huge pot of money over on the sidelines, and they want their revenue.
So it's a backdoor money grab, basically.
No question about it.
Well, so on that subject, and if we now think about what are some of the actionable ideas or items for the years ahead, and if we stay on the subject of the SECURE Act, given what you just outlined, what are some of the actionable steps that we should all be taking with this new policy in place?
Great. I just kind of reference back, and many of you heard me talk about this before, but this has been an issue for our practice for over 30 years, where we talked about why would you defer into an unknown tax paradigm? Well, that's exactly what's happened, and those that have these huge 401k plans or IRAs that are all pre-tax money are going to have a wake-up call. So the things that you should do, if you haven't already, and we're doing this proactively for our clients, is reevaluate the savings strategy. If you think all your money should go into a pre-tax 401k plan or IRA, maybe it shouldn't. Maybe it should go into a Roth. Maybe it should be saved on an after-tax basis. And also think, if you're a retiree, think about the distribution strategies. How do you get at your nest egg with the least amount of tax drag? Because remember, it's not how much you make, it's how much you make after taxes. Also, part and parcel of this is to make sure you're executing proper asset location. This becomes critically important if, in fact, returns are going to be lower and you're really trying to get the most out of your nest egg. You want to make sure you have the right type of asset in the right type of account. I think more and more people are going to explore Roth conversions. I think some, and this is an ongoing discussion we've had after the 17 tax bill, are looking at their charitable planning differently because many of the deductions have been taken away. but there is the option of what's called a QCD, Qualified Charitable Distribution from IRAs, that could satisfy a charitable intent without creating tax burden for the family. Most importantly, review beneficiaries, well, not most importantly, but equally importantly, is review beneficiaries, make sure that they're aligned properly with your estate plan. Many people name trusts as beneficiaries. That could be problematic in light of the SECURE Act. And make sure that you talk to your trust attorney about if they've named your IRA as the beneficiary of your trust, make sure they're aware of what the SECURE Act proposes for that.
So, I mean, a lot of what you just mentioned revolves around tax efficiency. And what you started with is, you know, this has been a core component of your practice for 30-plus years. So can you expand on just the importance of overall tax efficiency, why it's increasingly important, and are there any actionable examples that you could provide?
I think the context to think about this in is the fact that the tax code has increasingly been complicated and more complicated every year since I practice. And we think, and you and I have talked about this, that tax rates are likely to be increasing over time. The 17 tax bill was part of that. The SECURE Act is more of that. And I think in the current economic environment where you have the possibility of very low returns, rich equity valuations in the United States, a Federal Reserve Bank that's basically run out of bullets and doesn't have any more cards to pull out of the deck, then you better be looking at the tax efficiency of your construction of your nest egg, because if it's inefficient, you're going to pay a lot more than you need to, and you may have a whole lot less to live on when you need it.
So what I'm hearing is that if market returns moderate, you know, there's the ability to improve net returns via paying close attention to your tax flexibility, how you're saving, and your future distributions. Is that
absolutely? This is research done by two entities in the last 5 years. One, Vanguard, the big mutual fund sponsor that, you know, is known for their index funds, and the other is Morningstar, the big rating service for all the asset management firms and fund managers. Both have done studies independently pointing to the value of using an advisor, using a fiduciary who has tax planning as part of their mantra. Well, it's been part of ours for a long, long time, as everybody knows. It's on this call, I hope. But it's going to be really important for the general public going forward.
My next question is a little long-winded, so I apologize. But given all the subjects, you know, some of the key themes that we just touched on, low interest rates, rich U.S. equity valuations, the evolving tax environment that we're trying to prepare for, the wild card of negative interest rates, and what you just touched on, which was the Fed and other central banks maybe being short on resources. Is it time that we begin to reframe risk? And I guess what I mean by that is, you know, most people, when they think of risk, they think of their portfolio declining in value. But there are a lot of or many other lesser-known risks that are equally as important. You know, can you expand on the importance of reframing risk in this new environment that we're in and may be headed into?
I'll try. I'll be honest for our listeners and for you, and you've heard me talk about this, that, you know, it's really hard to wrap your head around negative interest rates. It's really hard to think about putting your money in the bank and having to pay them to hold on to it. But that's what a negative interest rate is. I think the best way for us to ponder some of these things is to think about the price of safety. So a negative interest rate means you're basically paying to guarantee that you get your money back. And part of the reason the valuations, particularly in the U.S. stock market, are so extended is because the investing public, including the pensions and all these other pools of assets, look at something like a Microsoft or a you know, McDonald's or some company with a big fat dividend and says, well, gee, I'd rather get my 2% in dividends and own a company than I would have fixed income asset that I'm going to have to pay to hold on to. So that's part of the reason we will never abandon the equity markets, but I think we should look at them more realistically as an income generator, not just a volatile asset class.
Now, what about foreign equity markets? Because equity markets here in the U.S., given their pricing, I mean, overall yields have, on a percentage basis, have come down. Is the same true when you look overseas and think about developed foreign markets or emerging markets? What's their yield situation like?
So the dividend yields overseas are closer to 3. We're closer to 2. So you can see immediately you get a almost 50% uptick in income alone. The other tailwind that could be a real plus for foreign assets is if the U.S. dollar starts to decline from the lofty levels it's currently at, that would provide a tailwind for foreign markets. So it's not, as I said earlier, it's not that we don't see value. It's relative value, and the relative valuations are probably better overseas right now. As I said earlier, this has been a decade of the U.S. It's been a decade of U.S. stock market, everything else. The rest of the world has really not participated, and they're probably due to.
Well, and if I may add to that, just that, you know, the foreign equity markets, especially the emerging markets, are known for their volatility. And it's really important, while we want to maintain equity exposure, that we be very realistic about how much volatility we can afford emotionally, and the amount of volatility as our plans can afford. And, you know, this is why our investment in Riskalyze felt timely, but also critical, because it's another way, it's an easier way for you, meaning our clients, and us to better understand your tolerance for volatility. So that, Tom, that wraps up the questions that I had for you. But before we conclude and open this up for questions, I do want to make a positive comment about progress, because it's easy for any one of us to look out at today's economic environment or political landscape and call out all that is wrong with it. Setbacks are easy to spot and can happen pretty quickly, but what's hard to acknowledge often is, or even see at times, is progress. And the 2010s may have assured all of us plenty of challenges in the years ahead, but positive seeds of change were also watered and cultivated. For example, renewable energy is poised for significant growth over the coming decade, and a wave of electronic or electric vehicles are expected to come to market. I mean, things that were once truly just a concept are expected to be priced on par with their combustion engine counterpart. We have advancements in healthcare, AI, robotics, and technologies like blockchain are literally reshaping our personal and professional lives as we speak. So alongside our need for caution is also great hope and excitement. And as all of you know, the only constant is change, and we have found that the best recipe for success is one you plan for. So to help everyone digest this call and some of the key themes that we just referenced, we have posted a slide deck to our website titled 2020 Outlook. So it's at thesedoricgroup.com. The slide deck is with charts because we know that a picture is worth 1,000 words. And with that, we appreciate everyone's time this afternoon. Tom, I'll turn it back to you, and I suspect we'll open it up for questions.
Thanks, Casey. And I think all of you have, most of you by now, have gone through what Casey mentioned earlier, which is the Riskalyze assessment. It's a tool that I wish I had had 30 years ago as I was starting my practice in this arena, because in many cases you think you know what a client's risk tolerance is, but it may be something different when they experience it. Riskalyze is Casey's recommendation to our practice, and it's been a huge home run for all of you that have really been able to see what would be a reasonable range of outcomes given your tolerance for volatility. And it's been hugely valuable to give people a context by which they own some of the things they own and why they own them. So on that note, kudos to you, Casey, but I want to open this up for any questions you might have. We may have talked a bit long, so if you're all asleep, I apologize. But Chloe, could you open this up for Q&A? And please remember, first names only to protect your privacy. Thank you very much.
this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, that's star and one, and we'll pause a moment to allow for questions to queue. That is star and one to ask a question today. We'll pause another moment.
And while we're waiting, if we overwhelmed you with information and you're digesting it and you want to send us an email later, you're more than welcome to. I just want to kind of reference what we're paid to do for you. And I think it's important is when we talk about tax planning and the value of critical thinking skills 30 years ago when we questioned the deferral as a tool to create wealth, we're paid to look around corners for all of you. We're paid to anticipate and plan for change. And I think as Casey said earlier, change is coming. You can embrace it and plan for it, or you can ignore it, but I think it's better off to plan for it. So are there any other questions, Chloe?
It does appear there are no questions at this time.
Well, we thank you all for coming out and joining us this afternoon. It's very important that we communicate. We do use multiple modes now, as you know. Obviously, email updates come out periodically. Our website is being refreshed and updated almost daily now. So if you're not spending time there and learning some of the things we hope you would know about, we want you to go to thesedorgroup.com more frequently if possible. And lastly is something that I think is important for you all to know in the background. I'm 65 years old. When I started 36 years ago, I wasn't. And since we're planners, we plan internally as well. So I want you all to know, and we're quite proud of this accomplishment, that in the last 17 years, the median age of this team has dropped by 17 years, which I'm quite proud of. So we're teed up to take care of you and your friends and family for the future, and we're very proud of the relationship we have with you. So thank you all.